Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.
Molly Guidra grew up in Ireland. English was her first language, but she studied Irish at school, and her parents speak Irish too, so she picked up words from them. Words became phrases, then sentences, then conversations. In her 20s, Molly traveled the world teaching English. And when she returned home, she taught online. Her students came from pretty much every time zone.
And they noticed I was Irish and they said, oh, can you teach Irish? And I was thinking, is there a demand for that? You know, and maybe I could see how we go. My first student was a woman in Florida who wanted to propose to her girlfriend in Irish. And
did she tell you why?
Her girlfriend was Irish, but I was thinking, is your girlfriend even going to understand this? You know, because there's some quite specific vocabulary there. But there are so many beautiful words around love that I was teaching her, you know, like mastor, like my little treasure, mastoreen, machushla, my pulse, magra, my love, machri, my heart. And I really enjoyed, you know, creating this world of words with her and preparing her for the big day.
There's also Seamus, who lives on a farm in Kentucky.
Seamus, he's such a special man. You know, super diligent, amazing learner. And he would speak Irish to his horses. He'd always send me beautiful photos of the dogs and the cats and the chickens and everything he was doing, keeping a diary in Irish and talking to himself in Irish, writing letters and poetry and then visiting Ireland whenever he could. And another guy in Texas, he had built an Irish pub in his basement. And he had like Tato crisps and all the things you want in an Irish pub.
Wait. It's in his basement? Does that mean that it was a real pub where other people would come, or it was just simply a personal pub. Vanity? Yeah, right.
Yeah. It was so beautiful as well. I think he'd got, you know, everything carved to perfection and all these beautiful old Guinness mirrors, and people just really immersed themselves in Irish culture. And I loved this idea that Irish is being spoken. It really moves me that Irish is being spoken around the world. If you believe you can do it, and if you're open enough to it, and you practice, and you're persistent and positive, you can achieve amazing results with language learning. If you're held back by the pain and resentment and bad memories of school and things, you don't believe it's ever going to work for you, and then it won't.
From Quiet Juice and the Linguistic Society of America, this is Subtitle, stories about languages and the people who speak them. I'm Patrick Cox. In this episode, the joy and the pain of the Irish language and all it stands for. A bit of history first. Irish is a Celtic language. It came from somewhere in Europe. The Romans came across some of these Celtic languages in somewhat earlier form when they arrived in what is today Germany, Austria, Belgium, northern Spain, and elsewhere. We're talking about the 4th to 5th centuries BC.
We don't know exactly when those languages came first to Britain and then to Ireland, but they were certainly well established before the Christian era.
This is Jim McCloskey. Jim was born in Ireland. He now teaches at the University of California at Santa Cruz.
So a lot of the literary traditions and story traditions that, you know, you can hear even today as folk tales have their origins in pre-Roman Gaul, pre-Roman Austria, and so on. And by mechanism we don't now fully understand, at the point when Christianity came in around the 4th, 5th century AD, some remarkable coming together of sort of classical learning and local learning produced a very standardized literary language, what we now call Old Irish.
Which made it one of the oldest literary languages in Europe, older than English. This was a golden age for Irish, and it pretty much stayed that way for centuries as the language evolved from Old Irish to Middle Irish to Modern Irish. There were invasions by the Normans and then the English, And over time, other languages, French and then English, established themselves in towns on the coast, port towns like Dublin. But until the English really put their foot down, Irish was predominant.
Until about 1620, 1630, Ireland was basically a monolingual country whose only language was Irish. It was only really with the expansion of English administrative power beyond the Pale, beyond Dublin, that that situation changes. So the crucial moment, the crucial initial moment in the decline of the language comes in the first half of the 17th century, not until then.
Oh, you mentioned beyond the Pale.
Yeah, the Pale was an imaginary fence around Dublin that kept the wild Irish at bay, and civilization, and English-speaking civilization, was safe inside the Pale in the capital city.
Yeah, I mean, you say the wild Irish. Was the language associated with this sort of wildness that increasingly, if from English eyes, needed to be tamed?
Absolutely.
Ah, the wild Irish and the civilized English. That myth has deep roots. And the trouble for the language was, it got caught up in that. You might even say it's still caught up in that, north of the border in Northern Ireland, which is still, of course, part of Britain. But the decline of Irish isn't just down to the Brits. Sure, they set it in motion, but later on, they got a big helping hand from a homegrown group.
The last steps in the elimination of Irish as a broadly spoken language, they were taken by a cooperative and collaborative effort between the colonial government in Dublin and the Catholic Church, the single two most powerful institutions that shaped the life of Ireland in the 19th century.
Yep, the Catholic Church, the very organization that centuries before had been the target of Britain's penal laws. Well, the Catholic Church survived, but over time it came to an understanding with Ireland's British rulers. The church, for example, ran the schools in Ireland. And here's an echo of the US and its policies toward Native Americans. Irish became banned in most schools.
To really remove a language from a community, you have to take a particular step. You have to convince the speakers of that language that it's a burden rather than a culturally useful tool. It's only at that point that they will take the extraordinary step of not speaking their native language to their own children. Any language that is eliminated, that's the crucial step that has to be taken in a single generation. A generation has to come to believe that their language is such a burden that they will not pass that burden on to their own children.
There were reasons to learn English. The potato famine of the 1840s, the Great Famine, it had wiped out 1 million Irish people, most of them from beyond the Pale, the West, where Irish was widely spoken. Another million, they fled the country in search of better lives. With it being so likely that their children would migrate to English-speaking countries, Britain, the US, Canada, places like that, it made sense that they learn English. But still, Irish families weren't just acquiring English. They were turning their backs on Irish.
Learning English does not entail necessarily abandoning the first language. Most people in the world have always been multilingual. The vast majority of human beings are multilingual, have always been multilingual. But that means in turn to persuade parents that they will hide their own language from their children, you have to work within the community. And so you need leaders within the community who will cooperate in that project.
It turned out to be hugely successful. Before the famine, 3 to 4 million people spoke Irish as their first language. A few decades later, fewer than a million did. Irish was falling off a cliff. Cue the Gaelic revival of the late 19th century. This was a movement to bring back the native language and culture. It soon got taken up by political revolutionaries, people who wanted to push the English out of Ireland. And so the Irish language became the symbol, not just of the nation, but of nationhood and independence. In 1916, Irish revolutionaries staged an uprising in Dublin, the Easter Rising. It failed in the short term. Most of the leaders were captured and killed. But it soon led to the end of British rule in all but the six counties that today constitute Northern Ireland. By 1922, the Irish were pretty much running their own affairs. 4 years later, this song officially became the Irish national anthem. The Soldier's Song, it was called. The lyrics were in English. And that's how it was memorized and sung by the first generation of children in a free Ireland. You may have heard that anthem being sung at sports events. And these days, it's always sung in Irish. So many painful ironies. The country's national anthem initially ignores its ancient native tongue. And then decades later, even as the rural Irish-speaking regions continue to shrink, Ireland's overwhelmingly English-speaking people belt out this song of patriotism in Irish. UC Santa Cruz's Jim McCloskey grew up only speaking English, a world away from those Irish language regions. But his father wanted him to learn Irish. So every summer, Jim was packed off to the west of Ireland.
Initially, I hated this experience. It was uncomfortable. It was agricultural. I was a middle-class urban child of the 60s. But gradually, over the years, the place and the community and all that it had sort of cast a spell on me. And by the time I was 17 or 18, it became a sort of teenage utopia for me, representing a kind of freedom and a kind of cultural richness. Because when you actually get into those communities, those Irish-speaking communities, you find this wealth of cultural resources, songs and music and stories, and it's an astonishingly still vibrant and culturally exciting community to be even peripherally a part of.
What kind of people were you staying with? What would be the jobs that they would do, and who would be the other people in the communities who you would meet?
This was part of a larger scheme set up by the government, one of the few successful strategies they had, which was they set up a system whereby urban kids like me could go to Irish-speaking areas in the summer, stay with local families in their farmhouses, attend classes during the day and various, you know, dances and musical events in the evening for roughly 3 weeks every summer. And there was a way of bringing middle-class urban Ireland into contact with the traditional Irish-speaking communities. And for some people like me, that experience turned them into good second-language speakers of Irish. It was a strange situation because the people we stayed with were extraordinarily poor. You know, they were subsistence farmers or they were agricultural laborers. They had virtually nothing. So I remember being 20 boys from various cities staying in this tiny, tiny farmhouse, three-room farmhouse. And at a certain point, I began to wonder where the man of the house, Mickey Chenye Lubuil, who was a wonderful storyteller, where he slept and his brother John slept. And one day I noticed that they were going out to the barn, the outhouse, and that's where they slept in the summer to make room for us language learners. And the man I stayed with was a very eminent, very well-known storyteller. And he would tell stories after dinner in this house, which I enjoyed at the time. But it was only later when I went to university and studied Celtic studies and archaeology and so on that I came to realize that the stories that he was telling and the characters that figured in those stories could be traced all the way back to pre-Roman Gaul, told and retold and retold and perfected over generations of oral transmission. So it was an extraordinary experience to be exposed to this ancient and rich culture in that time.
A few decades later, Molly Guidra, the Irish teacher, she also went to one of these language summer camps. By then, going to these camps had become something of a rite of passage for middle-class teenage kids from Dublin and other cities.
The one I attended was very strict, the strictest in the country. We had our phones confiscated. You get woken up by the Kinnara, who's like the prefect, and they go, Shacking the chuid bearla, like mind your English, you know, just to kind of catch you before you might utter an English word. And I spoke one sentence of English and I got sent home. Thankfully, it was at the end of the course, so I didn't miss too much. Yeah, but I was on the train home from Galway and crying my eyes out. I was lucky enough to argue my case that that wasn't fair at all, that they kicked me out and they gave me a scholarship and I went back.
In a moment, Molly grades my Irish father's pronunciation and she teaches me how to say jellyfish in Irish. I want to tell you now about another language-themed podcast. It's called The Vocal Fries, and it's about linguistic discrimination. There is a rich seam of material here, which we at Subtitle have mined from time to time, including right now with this Irish episode. But for a far deeper dive, you should check out The Vocal Fries. What is it about the way people speak and the way they write that makes others judge them harshly and unfairly, and often as a sneaky way to be racist, sexist, or classist? The hosts of The Vocal Fries are Carrie Gillen and Megan Figueroa, and unlike me, they are linguistic scholars. They know what they're talking about. They're also great fun to listen to. So, if you want to learn how to stop being an accidental jerk about language, listen to The Vocal Fries wherever you're listening to this, or go to vocalfriespod.com.
I love how Irish is so literal. Like a jellyfish is literally the snot of a seal. So we say, smuggerlia rowan. Smuggerlia is snot.
Smuggerlia.
Perfect. Smuggerlia. With an a rotagar there in the middle, smuggerlia. And rowan is of a seal.
Rowan.
Rowan. Smuggerlia rowan.
Smuggerlia rowan.
Another one I love is spider is a fierce little stag. So it's Dawan Alla.
Dawan Alla. Is that a soft D sound at the beginning?
Yes, exactly. The kind of a.
The oh, yeah. The Dawan
Alla.
Alla. Now, if that sounds a bit intimidating, Molly says, don't be put off.
It's not one of the hardest languages in the world to learn. It's only got 11 irregular verbs. English has about 220. And sometimes I think of languages like Portuguese, where the word for your, the possessive, is like, it can be masculine, feminine, plural, and then your plural comes in. But with Irish, it's just one word, like the, meaning your, or ver, your plural. So in many ways, it's a very patterned language, a very logical language, and very satisfying to learn. Even the pronunciation, people probably wouldn't believe this, but you start seeing BH as V at the end of a word, or W if it's beside a broad vowel. And it's a very fun kind of puzzle to pick apart. It's so uplifting because you're growing and you know you're learning and you feel like you're getting better at something.
I love that feeling.
Really, yeah.
Okay, sure, I do love it, even if I don't feel that love very much in my current struggles with Chinese. But I have felt it in the past with easier languages. Making that breakthrough in conversation when you almost forget to think in English, you're not translating from English, you're just living in the world of that other language. It feels really good. And it must be especially good to have that feeling in Irish. It never happened to my dad, which he regretted. Back then, Irish had only recently been reintroduced into the schools as part of this new sort of rebranding of the Irish state. And he was one of that first generation of kids.
I was learning Irish from when I was about five and a half until I left school, taught by the nuns.
I interviewed my dad about this a few years before he died in 2016. The way he described it, the Irish that was taught back then was a quaint, old-fashioned, literary version of the language. Not conversational at all, with one exception that's coming up. Anyway, I played this to Molly.
So, Dad, tell me the words that you know in Irish.
I know how to count to nine. Indo 3, Kahar Kuig She Shakt Hokne. That is 1-9. And then also I remember this little request. On Will Kadagom Dolamak Marshe de Holly.
What does that mean?
It means, please, miss, may I leave the room.
Did you get that right?
Yeah, beautiful accent. Lovely Irish, absolutely. So the second one is literally, can I go out, please? Or with your will, is how we say please in Irish. And I made a post about this yesterday because I was saying, it seems like the only thing people can remember from school is, can I go to the toilet? And in some schools, they didn't let you say the word toilet. So you'd say, can I go out? Like your father said. And I was thinking, how can we make the language more memorable? How can we ingrain phrases in a way that's useful and people can use the language spontaneously? And I thought, maybe it's because the stakes are high. If you need the toilet, you're going to say it perfectly. And you're going to say it multiple times a day. And the teacher won't let you go unless you say it properly. If it became more of a natural and everyday language in schools, like it was in my school, to be fair, in primary school, it would build confidence in people and help them see the language in a different way. It's really sometimes focused on as an exam subject instead of just enjoy it, love it. It's part of who we are. It's our soul language. And it's so important to understanding the imagination and the humor and the life of Ireland.
I'm surprised that even after all this time, Molly finds a rigidity about how Irish is taught at school. But I have to keep reminding myself that Irish is still a minority language, a threatened language. Talking in Irish, just chatting, it doesn't seem natural to that many people, Molly aside. If they were learning Spanish, say, it wouldn't be a problem at all. Just go to a Spanish-speaking country. But Irish learners, they need to really seek out places to hear the language in its untamed form.
They're not really exposed to natural conversation or listening to podcasts. And that's what's great about Spotify and YouTube, and TG Cahit is the TV station and they have a player online. So you can access that from anywhere in the world. There's a kids version called Kula Cahit, and they have like SpongeBob in Irish. So that's brilliant. You know, a lot of creators are now on TikTok and Instagram, and not only teachers and creators, but others learning Irish and sharing their journey. And people are realizing, yeah, we do have this indigenous native language. It's our official language. It's ancient, and it's so different to English. You know, it's a different language entirely.
It's true. English could hardly be more different, except when Irish people speak English.
Maybe it's being colonized and speaking another language, but really speaking our own language. The way we speak English in Ireland is really haunted by the language. And there are so many phrases and the syntax we use and so many loan words from Irish people aren't even aware of.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I remember sort of noticing, I noticed nothing in my father, because you notice nothing in your own parent, right? With the way that they speak. But, you know, we would go out to Ireland a couple of times a year to see family and everything on his side. I remember my aunt would never, ever, ever say yes or no. Never. And then I clocked. I'm like, oh, that's just like my dad. I will.
Because there is no word for yes or no in Irish. We answer with the verb. So that's the thing. If you say like, I'm digging to, do you understand? You'd say tigum, I understand. Or nihigum, I don't understand. And even saying so it is at the end, you know, like she's my friend, so she is, comes from Irish, because using the copula structure, we add on the pronoun at the end as well. That has kind of seeped into how we speak English. We don't have a present perfect in Irish. So instead of saying, I have read the book, we would say, I'm after reading the book. That's why Irish people use after a lot. Like, oh, I'm after just after talking to Patrick. Even little things like using altogether after an adjective in a different way altogether. You know, we'd say, that's gas crack altogether. Or she's brilliant altogether. And you don't hear that in British English or Australian English. And lots of things like the Irish accent, you know, how melodic it is and how musical. The stress patterns are coming from the Irish language and the way we pronounce TH or get mocked for not being able to pronounce TH because that sound doesn't exist in Irish. Another thing is we don't have the verb to have in Irish. We say things are at us. So people are gas. Like people are so funny, they'll go, I haven't got a word of Irish. Oh, sure, I haven't got a word. And I'm thinking, that's an Irish structure you're using. If you weren't Irish, you might say, I don't speak Irish, instead of I haven't got it. It's just everywhere in the way the Irish speak. You know, even thanks a million coming from Gurv Mila Mila Mahagat. May you have a thousand, thousand goodness. And I remember reading about how Irish adjectives, they're so onomatopoeic and they're so vibrant, you know, like a lot of them end with ach, like salach is dirty, ufasach is awful. Apparently, this is why Irish people, we can't just say, oh, that was good. We have to say like, that was absolutely delectable. Like we love going above and beyond, you know, instead of just welcome. It's like 100,000 welcomes. Yeah, I was teaching last night how saying hello in Irish in the past, people would say, Giarich, which is like God to you, to bless someone. And then you respond, God and Mary, back to you. And then the first person says, God, Mary and Joseph. God, Mary, Joseph and Jesus. God, Mary, Joseph, Jesus, Bridget, Patrick, and all the blessed saints. So there might be like some just fear of the silence. People just love to talk, love to keep it going. And it's a very tender and humorous language that is full of kindness and also perception. Everything's very positioned around us. Things are on us, within us, beside us, at us. Like, for example, you're welcome. We'd say there's welcome before you, or the feeling is on me. So these things really inspire a sense of space. If you listen to Irish people speaking English, I'd say more than half of it, you can trace it back to Irish.
After all of those years of suppression, the language has embedded itself in the language of the longtime colonial occupier. Whatever it takes to keep the language alive, right? Today, though, many Irish people, especially the older generations, they have mixed feelings about the history of the language, the attempts to suppress it, and more recently, to revive it.
I think it might be too painful for people to even fathom learning it or speaking it, and they have an aversion to it, like as if Irish speakers think they're the elite or that they're superior. And I think a lot of that baggage and those feelings come from a shame, you know, where people really have this deep-rooted regret and they think, oh, the biggest regret of my life is I'll, you know, I've never learned Irish. I'd love to speak our native language. I'd love. And I say, you're still alive. You know, you're able to tell me that you want to speak the language and I'm here for that. And there's so many materials now and resources and ways that you can connect with the language. I was thinking about this very recently, what a survivor she is as a language. Languages in Irish are feminine, apart from English, which is masculine. But surviving the Norman invasion, the Statute of Kilkenny, British colonial rule since the 12th century, the famine, death, emigration, modernization, urbanization, education policies. And still, against all odds, clinging on there.
Clinging on and changing fast. Documented by researchers at universities. What kind of guiding hand should the language receive at this time of change? Should it change at all? There's a whole lot of should when it comes to Irish. Should the language expand to include versions of Irish spoken by young Dubliners or people in the United States proposing marriage to their loved ones? These are people far from the native Irish-speaking regions of the west of Ireland. The change is coming from these other speakers of the language, people who grew up speaking English but have, to a greater or lesser extent, embraced Irish on their terms. It may be an Irish that sometimes ignores classic pronunciation or certain aspects of the grammar, sometimes even throws in some English words. Should the language allow for that? or should it stay pure, keeping that original nation-building flame alight? It's fraught. Ireland has suffered so many betrayals over the years. Who may be doing the betraying now? Again, there are echoes of Native American languages and their struggles. And this is why there are language purists in Ireland, some in powerful positions overseeing policy. Don't mess with the language, or at least don't mess too much. That's their message. The language defines us as a people. We brought it back after we won independence in 1922. You may not like the way we taught it and dressed it up in a narrative about what it is to be Irish. You may call the effort a failure because you don't remember the words you learnt at school. But it gave you a sense of being, of home. And yet, living languages change. That's what they do. And if they don't change, it's an indication they're dying. According to the most recent census in 2022, 72,000 people in Ireland speak Irish on a daily basis, not counting students who only speak it at school. 72,000. So it's not going to disappear tomorrow. But that same census found that 124,000 people in Ireland speak Polish on a daily basis. So what's the way forward for Irish?
There's another context in which one might look at this whole effort, and that is in the context of the global issue of language loss and the loss of linguistic diversity.
We're back with Jim McCloskey of UC Santa Cruz.
And in that larger context, in a fundamentally sort of anti-nationalist perspective on the issue, it doesn't matter much that this new language doesn't much resemble traditional Irish at all. The fact is it's a new linguistic variety. Is being used for interesting creative purposes and interesting community purposes. And it is thereby increasing the store of linguistic and cultural diversity in the world. And if your goal in quote-unquote preserving Irish is to increase the store of linguistic and cultural diversity in the world today, then one has to say that this has been a partial success, because that community of second language speakers would not have existed if that project had not been initiated in 1922.
Thanks to Jim McCloskey and to Molly Guidra. Molly, by the way, says her student in Florida who proposed in Irish got the answer she was looking for. Not only that, but Molly says she's actually brought together three or four other couples through the medium of Irish, as taught by her. Thanks also to Alison Shao, who manages Subtitle's social media and writes the newsletter, which you can sign up for at subtitlepod.com/newsletter. That's subtitlepod.com/newsletter. Thanks also to everyone at the World Public Radio Program. Subtitle is a member of the Hub and Spoke Audio Collective. We're a bunch of independently minded podcasters who are curious about a bunch of stuff, science stuff, tech stuff, arty stuff, language stuff, of course. And we figure that you're curious about these things too. So here's a shout out for some of the other Hub and Spoke podcasts: Soonish, Open Source, The Briny, and Out There. You can find out about these and all of the other podcasts at hubspokeaudio.org. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. See you in a couple of weeks.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.